The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more, and we bring you this podcast almost every week, every year. And if you're listening to this podcast and you like this podcast, please give us 5 stars and drop a little review for us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you happen to be listening to it. We would certainly appreciate your patronage. We have a great show for you this week. I am going to talk to contributor Samuel Porteous, coming to us from Shanghai, China. He's going to talk to me about Chaos, which is a new Netflix series, British series, about the a modern take on the Greek gods, let's put it this way, with Jeff Goldblum as Zeus. Not everyone's first casting choice as Zeus, but it's created some interesting conversation-worthy reviews, and we're going to have a conversation about that. I'm also going to talk to Pablo Gallaga about Strange Darling, which is kind of an indie grindhouse horror serial killer movie that I saw on a recent trip to Los Angeles and has been playing at festivals and is well worth a discussion and is also a lot of fun and very twisty. But first, I'm going to summon Stephen Garrett from the Toronto Film Festival, where he has not seen this movie at the film festival. He saw it earlier, but we're going to talk about Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, believe it or not, the sequel to the original Beetlejuice, and that's in theaters now. And Stephen will pop up from the film critic underworld right after this musical interlude.
I can't believe I'm doing this. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Now's my chance.
I need you to help me save my daughter.
I swear on my dead mother's soul. Hey, let's go, honey.
Confronting the unknown, there's nothing harder.
You're that thing from my dream.
Really more nightmare material.
Stephen Garrett, Stephen Garrett, Stephen Garrett.
Aha! You've conjured me.
I didn't want to, but I had no choice.
Does this mean we have to marry? Do I have to marry you now?
No, no, no. I'm already married. Oh, okay. I'm already betrothed to my true love, who I saw Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice with on Friday afternoon. And I know you've also seen Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, because you wrote a review of it, and I read your review, and it was accurate. So you weren't making it up. You weren't pretending that you'd seen Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. The sequel, 40 years in the making, the sequel to Beetlejuice.
Almost 40 years. What was it, 36?
Almost 40 years.
Something like that.
86, yeah. So basically 40 years ago, the original Beetlejuice came out. And now there's another one. And, you know, the thing about Tim Burton movies is, like, there's been this pattern over the years, right? Like, I'm always like, oh, a Tim Burton movie, that'll be fun. And then I go to see the Tim Burton movie, and I always feel a little let down, a little depressed.
It's not fun.
It's not fun.
Because he's not having fun. Like, is he having fun making Dumbo? Is he having fun making Dark Shadows? Maybe a little on Dark Shadows, but his movies have really lost their spark. I mean, it's been decades. He just does franchise movies. He does, oh, what do you want me to remake? Wonka? Okay, fine. I'll remake Willy Wonka. I'll remake Planet of the Apes. I'll remake this.
Yeah, that was bad. That said, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice is kind of fun.
It's fun. It's actually kind of fun. You know, like, there was a point in his career, early in his career, where he had fun making his movies and people had fun watching his movies. Like, what, from Pee-wee's Big Adventure to, like, Ed Wood. And even Mars Attacks, which is uneven, but he still is having a blast doing it. And there's some funny moments, right?
Right. And Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice is a franchise movie, but it's his franchise.
Exactly. It didn't mean to be a franchise movie. And exactly, he created the world that he is just continuing to build with this movie or just revisiting. And it's wacky and weird and fun in a way that only Tim Burton could do. Because, like you're saying, he created this franchise. Nobody else could do. Well, I guess there was a cartoon, right? Wasn't there an animated
series? There was an animated series and lots of toys. And as we saw in the Alamo Drafthouse pre-show, there were, like, you know, amusement park attractions, like musical reviews. And, you know, Beetlejuice is kind of an enduring part of the pop culture landscape.
And the Broadway show, too, right?
Which was popular. I didn't see it.
Which was popular. I was about to say, like, I like that you say which was popular. I saw it when it came out, and I, you know, a friend of mine invited me along because he likes taking me to Broadway versions of movies.
Yeah.
So, like, there was a Broadway show of Rocky. Do you remember that started in Germany?
I did not see that, but I do remember that there was a Rocky musical.
There was a Rocky musical. It was originally called Das Rocky, and it had a big fight. The big climax, they turned the stage, they pushed the stage out into the audience, and it was a big boxing ring. And that was at the Winter Garden Theater, as was Beetlejuice. And we both saw it, and it was big and bawdy and gaudy and loud. And we were like, yeah, okay.
Kind of like this movie, big and bawdy and gaudy and loud. Let's talk about this as a film. Like, I felt like, as you said in your review, it's messy, right? And I felt like the second half was much more fun and much better.
It was certainly, it gets off the rails a bit. You know, like, they just kept adding more, you got to admit, wasn't there like three or four scenes where it was just characters giving exposition to each other? For like, yes. A long stretch, yeah, right in the middle. You're just like, what?
Well, and also, here's the thing. Michael Keaton plays Beetlejuice, and he hasn't lost a step in the role, in my opinion, you know, at all. Right, and he enjoys himself. But, you know, the thing about that character is you conjure him up. You say his name three times, and then he appears, and then everything goes to shit. And, all you know, and, like, he sets the plot into motion. In this movie, he just kind of pops up in a scene, and there he is. And I think that was a mistake, because it took the element of, like, launching him into the movie, which does happen, but he's already there, so it's, maybe Winona Ryder sees him for the first time in 40 years, but we've seen him already for several scenes, and so it doesn't have the same element of surprise and fun.
And anarchy, yeah. In a way, he's a little like Barbara Eden, right? He's like I Dream of Jeannie, like they conjure him, he does things that they need him to do. Things get a little out of control at the end, and then they find a way to get rid of him. But he's actually a little more benevolent in this. He resolves a lot of anarchy instead of creating more anarchy, I feel.
I mean, what I like about the character is he's very self-interested, right? Like, he's not trying to save the world. He's just trying to get laid.
Right. But he's a little more horny in the previous one. In this one, it's like, instead of a strip club down in the model town, there's like a doctor's office. You know,
where he spills his guts. Okay.
That's funny. But the baby Beetlejuice. No spoilers. I mean, maybe it's a little
really evil and fun, kind of
Chucky-like. Adorable. Chucky-like Beetlejuice baby.
And then you have Winona Ryder playing the same character she played in the first Beetlejuice, who's now a grown woman who, I thought it was very clever. They have her hosting like a Ghost Adventures kind of show.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Pretty good. And then
she's late Winona, right? She's the rattled, kind of shell-shocked Winona instead of the over-it hip Winona when she was.
Yeah, she's like loony, wide-eyed Winona, which I liked and was accurate. And then Catherine O'Hara playing the same character she did in the first film, you know, basically playing Moira Rose from Schitt's Creek.
Yeah, true. But, you know, she's so good and fun.
So good.
I mean, she's just, you know, delightful.
There's a lot of scenes of just Catherine O'Hara. There's a lot.
There are. There are a few too many scenes of Justin Theroux. I feel like his character was kind of like annoying. And too few scenes with Monica Bellucci. Give us more Monica Bellucci. What kind of threat is she? She's supposed to be this big threat that appears in the beginning of the movie and then kind of disappears in the movie.
Yeah, one of the most, and not to mention one of the most beautiful women in the world.
Even with staples in her face, she's gorgeous.
Done up like Morticia Adams. and then also, so Justin Theroux, way too much of him. And also way too much, I hate to say it, of Jenna Ortega, who plays Winona Ryder's daughter. I mean, look, Jenna Ortega is a very lovely young woman, but I felt like her character, she was kind of flat, and her character was kind of flatly written.
Yeah, because it's, I think, you know, and to his credit, I don't know how well it works, but he does try to have a little bit of, kind of heartfelt feelings and, you know, a little bit of tragedy in these people's lives that's explored. Like, she's, you know, Jenna Ortega's character is motivated by her, the fact that she misses her dad who divorced, you know, Winona Ryder's character, you know, a few years ago and is now dead. And Jenna Ortega doesn't believe that her mom actually sees spirits. And the main reason being, like, she won't even show her dead dad.
The problem is, though, you know, Winona Ryder's character, Lydia, in the original movie was like this truly bizarre, cynical goth
right.
girl. Yes. And Jenna Ortega does not feel like that to me at all. She feels very generic.
Yeah, she's a mean teen, like bitter that her parents are divorced. Yeah,
kind of. Yeah. Kind of. It's just boring. It's sorry. Oh, so that said, when once we really kind of descend into the afterlife, the spirit realm, or whatever the hell, wherever the hell all the dead people live, the movie really has a lot of fun, anarchic energy, good, really imaginative set pieces, lots of goofy practical effects.
So many great practical effects, and they're so great because they're practical. Like, it didn't feel like smothered in CGI. These were like really handcrafted, artisanal, goofy practical effects, right? You know?
Guts and blood.
And great sight gags. The waiting room guys, like I love the waiting. Every time they went back to the waiting room, you saw another dead body, like patiently taking a number.
All the wacky shrunken head dudes.
Those are great.
Lots of fun. And let's not forget the movie's truly secret weapon, Willem Dafoe.
I mean, really? I don't know. I feel like he was. Oh, I mean, what I the hell was stuff. His role in that movie? He was totally ineffectual.
He was not a plot element, but it was. I found that character to be extremely funny. He basically is a former TV actor who played a cop, and so now is a cop in the afterlife, but isn't actually a cop. He's an actor playing a cop, and everyone knows it, and so he only can utter like TV cop cliches.
Somebody was like, hey, you know, it'd make this funny. Let's get Willem Dafoe just to overact in our movie and ham it up.
The thing is, like, there wasn't.
He does nothing.
He does nothing, but there wasn't too much of him. And I thought it was funny. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But
it was funny. I think I just wished there was a point to his role.
Yeah.
Which there really, it was pointless. He was a pointless character.
Indeed. Well, most of the, you know, this is a Beetlejuice sequel we're talking after all.
This is a Beetlejuice.
You know, I mean, it's, I want to hate everything, as you know. But I didn't hate it. I found it pretty amusing. And the musical number at the end, was pretty wacky and fun.
And that song choice, I mean, wonderful. Wonderful. Like, it's wonderfully weird and dated in such a wonderful way. It was like such a deep cut that like only somebody like Tim Burton would be like, oh yeah, remember that song? Let's bring this back.
I don't know. Like, also like the actual very, very ending of the movie, I thought was fun and subversive.
Yeah, he's having fun with this. I mean, it's like kudos. I wish studio movies would be more like this. And I feel like maybe he's one of the last who can actually do this. People give him $100 million to do something this wacky, and audiences will line up.
They gave him $100 million.
Yeah, and the movie's going to make $100 million. So it's like,
at least. But I'm just like, wow, that just seems like I'm hoping for people. Somebody give me a $5,000 book advance.
You should write about Beetlejuice, and they'll give you money. It's money in the bank, baby.
All right, I'll keep that.
He's the ghost with the nose. He's the juice, right? The juice is loose. I thought that was O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, but he's dead, and Beetlejuice is not.
Beetlejuice is technically dead, just for the record.
Right, but he's not gone.
Actually, you know what? I got super sad when one of the shrunken head guys got his soul sucked out. Didn't you tear up a little?
Yeah, they paid him homage. They paid him wonderful homage in the end credit.
Was like, beautiful. I love that. I actually love that. That's so silly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is Beetlejuice for you. Steven, the contract that we signed for Book and Film Globe, there's a clause in it, and you didn't read it carefully, and now that this review is over, I banish you back to the eternal realm.
This is a dramatization of the true story of the final known killings of the most prolific and unique American serial killer of the 21st century.
You know you asked for this, right?
Gotcha.
So when I was in Los Angeles recently, I took a side trip to the Vista Theater in Los Feliz, the Quentin Tarantino recently purchased and restored Vista Theater. And it was just a great movie-going experience. The restoration is beautiful. It's one big screen in an old movie house, and they show everything on either 35 or 70 millimeter. There's no digital screenings of movies there. And there's also this great 1970s-themed coffee shop that Tarantino owns next door called Pam's Coffee. And I even bought a mug. I bought a souvenir mug. I spent $30 on a coffee mug, which is, I'm a very cheap traveler in general. So that was a big souvenir purchase for me. And the movie I saw at the Vista Theater was called Strange Darling. And it is an appropriate movie to see at that theater because this is a film that I feel like is very heavily influenced by Quentin Tarantino and especially by some of his earlier films. And I have Pablo Gallaga, who did not see Strange Darling at the Vista Theater, as far as I know, here today to talk to me about it. Hello, Pablo.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. So I'm guessing you saw this at a festival or something along those lines.
Yeah. Interesting enough, I saw it at Fantastic Fest last September, and it took 11 months for it to be released. My understanding is they struggled to find distribution because this is a tough one to market since there is some twists and turns in this one.
There are a lot of twists and turns. And also, I mean, look, this is not a mainstream film. You know, it's got a very sort of indie vibe to it. It makes sense that you saw it at Fantastic Fest because it's about a serial killer, and it does not skimp on the blood and the sex and the cringe. I mean, not cringe as in awkward to watch, but like just difficult to watch because there's some scenes of sort of extreme graphic violence. But that said, it's a really fun and twisty thriller.
Yeah, it's an erotic thriller, as you say, and it does lean into some horror tropes. So, yeah, that's, I think you mentioned, not really over-the-top gore. There is some blood. But, yeah, it's pulling from influences like Duel, Spielberg's Duel, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's got, like, this really bold opening crawl that's voiced over by Jason Patrick of The Lost Boys fame. So, yeah, it definitely has a little bit of horror in there, but it's mostly a thriller.
I agree with those influences, although, again, I think the main influence is Quentin Tarantino. If you look at his early, at Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, this movie shares some similarities. It has an unconventional narrative structure. It's told 6 chapters, but told out of order.
Yeah, nonlinear.
Nonlinear narrative, which I normally hate, and I still don't love, even in this movie. But given that the movie is highly dependent on some small twists and then one major twist, which I guessed early on, but I won't reveal here, that it makes some sense. Because if you told it linearly, you would, by the time you were halfway through, you would know what was going on. It would just have turned into like a standard chase picture.
I think it's used to great effect. I don't want to be misremembering here, but I think in the Q&A at Fantastic Fest, somebody asked J.T. Mulner if the film had ever, in any iteration in the scripting, been written linearly. And he's like, no, just wouldn't work. Like, it just, the story is not made for that. It needs to be kind of told in this jumbled fashion to kind of do some of these rug pulls that they do.
And that's kind of what Tarantino did in Pulp Fiction. He was the first director to really pull that off effectively. This movie is not Pulp Fiction. That is a singular film that changed the language of cinema forever. I don't think this is that.
I don't think it's trying to be. Like I say, it's pulling it from Grindhouse like Tarantino does, but it's not developing these three-dimensional characters, really. They're kind of these two-dimensional, you have the demon and the lady as the two main, I think you said in your review that it's almost like a two-person play for most of it.
Yeah, there's a few side characters. I mean, there's some fun semi-cameos by Ed Begley Jr. and Barbara Hershey. I hadn't seen Barbara Hershey in a movie in a long time. She was good and fun. And Ed Begley Jr. is always entertaining to watch. And then there was some sort of toward the end of the movie, we started seeing some more people involved, people worked for cops, people who worked in motels, et cetera, just rural people in Oregon. But they weren't around for most of the movie. It was mostly these two characters. So let's talk about these actors, right? So you have the demon is played by a guy named Kyle Gallner. Not an actor I was super familiar with, but he's been obviously, I looked at his IMDb page. He's been a working character actor in Hollywood for a long time.
He's been doing some horror. He was in Smile, the 2022 Scream, and The Passenger. So he's got a following. He's got he's up and coming, and I really did like him in this one. But I think we need to talk
great,
about...
Great mustache. Great yeah, mustache.
The mustache doing a lot of the work. But yeah, we got to talk about Willa Fitzgerald because she...
Yeah,
she
he was good. Show. He was good, but Willa Fitzgerald, that lady can act.
Yeah, she's a young Madeline in The Fall of the House of Usher, which also those episodes premiered at Fantastic Fest last year. So she was having a moment at that festival in September of last year.
And she was the love interest, second lead in season one of Reacher, which I watched. And you know, my wife and I watched that together. And we both instantly were like, she's got a lot of charisma.
Yeah, definitely. She was also in the Scream television series. So both leads here having a connection to the Scream franchise.
I mean, and I would say Gallner is good. He holds the screen very well. But she, I mean, her character is more nuanced and requires a lot. She just does a lot of incredible work in this movie. I mean, it's a really captivating performance.
They ask her to do a lot, and I think she nails it throughout. There's not a moment where you're kind of doubting or not. Like, I've seen it twice. I saw it at the festival, and I saw it when it released wide recently. And it holds up. Like, when you know it's coming, you don't kind of, like, see any sort of wavering there.
Yeah. I mean, it is a complete work. I'm not as maybe enthralled with it as some genre people are, just because the non-conventional narrative structure to me is the entire point. Like, I feel like it's not about anything other than the visceral experience of seeing it happen.
There's a bit of a subversion of some archetypes and stereotypes. I think that's what Molnar has said that he intended to do with it. But yeah, I mean, you're not approaching a Pulp Fiction. You're not getting to... No one's going to put this in like an awards conversation or anything like that. But I fully agreed when I read your review that this is a killer for midnighters at like the Draft House. Like this will kill there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, for a certain kind of cinema lover, it is a real classic. And I would say that I agree that it's not going to get any major awards consideration. Although, you know, would... that we would live in a world where Willa Fitzgerald's performance could get her considered for something.
Agreed. Cinematography-wise, this is Giovanni Ribisi's first time as a feature cinematographer, the actor who's been in everything from Friends to Selma.
Yeah.
That was his first go at it, and they shot in 35mm, as you got to see in L.A., yeah, it's. I think it has some legs potentially as like this unconventional love story, maybe. But
maybe
we'll see. We'll see.
Maybe
it's there. It's definitely there, and the intent is there for that to be there. But
it's been struggling to find an audience and struggling to find wider distribution. I follow Kyle Gallner on Twitter, or at least he pops up on my feed because I've tweeted about this movie through the Book and Film Globe account, and you know, people like it, but I think it's. This does not have mainstream appeal.
It's not for everyone for sure. In the Fantastic Fest screening, there were people that walked out in that first act, and Molnar was like, oh, I just wish they had kind of stayed for a few more minutes before, you know, they learned more about what was going on.
I never once, and as you know, as we've talked about frequently on this podcast, I'm not a great lover of horror. Walking out wasn't even a consideration. I was like, oh, I was like deep in it. And I really recommend you go see something at the Vista if you're ever in LA or the New Beverly, the Tarantino-owned movie theaters. I mean, there's nothing like going to see a movie in those theaters because you really feel like you're in a temple of cinema, and this kind of cinema in particular.
I wish I could have seen it there.
It was fun. They showed a cartoon before too.
Perfect. I could understand, and I assume I didn't see for myself, but I would think it was women walking out. There's some arresting imagery here that, you know, it's understandable that there's some triggering that could happen with some of what you see in this film.
There's some violence against women for sure, but like you said, the movie sort of plays with your expectations of that in a very interesting way. So I don't feel like this is an anti-feminist movie. And I don't think it's a strongly feminist movie either, but it's not, you know, I don't feel like misogyny really is like a theme here.
No, and I don't think it strongly goes one way or the other. I think it's having commentary on it because we're certainly in this, you know, post Me Too moment. There's some stuff in the final act that is, you know, pulling from that, but I could understand, you know, this not being your jam, but my advice is always to stick with it and see, you know, engage with it, see what the filmmaker is trying to do.
All right. Well, Strange Darling may not be for everyone, but it was really for Pablo Gallego, and it was even kind of for me.
It was for you a little, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hate. I mean, I gave it a tomato instead of a splat on Rotten Tomatoes. So
well, there you go.
I mean, I don't want to be like a guy in his 50s who's like, ew, that's just inappropriate and too violent. You have to kind of look at it as a movie, you know, and as a movie, it holds together from pole to pole.
Love hurts, Neil. Love hurts.
Yeah, there's a lot. You got to really be willing to sit through some playings of the song Love Hurts. You really do. Because if you don't like that song, you're not going to like this movie. All right. Pablo, thank you so much. And we will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Neil.
Blessed Olympia.
Give it to me.
The gods. They don't give a shit about any of us. I defy the gods.
I'm going to wipe these fuckers right off the face of the fucking earth.
The Greek gods are always a source of entertainment, just like we are a source of entertainment for the Greek gods. But it's proven surprisingly difficult to make good television about the Greek gods. There was a recent Disney Channel remake of the Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief books by Rick Riordan, but those are very young adult oriented. My wife kind of liked the show. I just cannot get into that interpretation of Greek myth. And now we have on Netflix, we have a more, let's say, adult take on Greek myth. It's called Chaos. And Samuel Porteous, frequent Book and Film Globe contributor, has reviewed Chaos for us. And he joins me on the podcast from his home in Shanghai, China, where it is, I think, 3 a.m. right now, right? Hello, Samuel.
Closer to 12 midnight, but yeah, hello, Neil.
Yeah, I don't, you know, podcasting after midnight, you're going to turn into a pumpkin. So Chaos is now on Netflix. And, you know, these attempts to sort of do Greek myth in a modern setting. I know this is something that Neil Gaiman has done in American Gods, but he covers a lot of different other mythologies. But, you know, and Chaos feels to me like has a sort of a similar Gaiman-like take on the gods in our modern world. Maybe I'm mistaken here.
It is similar to what Gaiman does in that they apply a modern sensibility to, you know, the peccadilloes and personalities of the Greek gods, which were pretty, you know, ribald even in the Greek telling of them, right? That was one of the basic attractions, that they were basically superior beings with, you know, the flaws of humans attached to them. And right. You definitely see that in Chaos.
Right. They were immortal, but they were not immune to flaws.
Absolutely. They were not, goals as far as examples for human behavior in any way.
No. Here's the thing about Chaos, right? The central attraction for a viewer is that Zeus, the king of the gods, is played by Jeff Goldblum.
Yes.
Of all people, which seems like a very odd casting.
Well, originally, remember, it was Hugh Grant.
That makes more sense.
As they got closer to filming, and apparently, you know, Charlie Koval was, you know, being British, and this is a very British series, by the way, and we can talk about that later. Charlie Koval was ecstatic that Hugh Grant had signed on for this. And then, you know, just before they began filming, he had to bail for, you know, the usual other commitments.
He was too busy playing an Oompa Loompa in Wonka or something.
Yeah, I think he might have taken a closer look at the scripts.
Right. Yeah, I will say, Sam, that your review of Chaos did not exactly have me diving for the remote.
Well, you know what? It's fascinating because, you know, curious, having written the review, I went and took a look and see what, you know, what others had, had put forward. And I saw an interesting, you know, split between the British reviews and some of the, you know, Los Angeles-based industry reviews. And the ones in Britain tended to be, you know, some of them, like The Guardian, my God, they gushed over it, said it was a masterpiece. Yeah. Mm. And then you look at the, you know, some of the ones coming out of LA that, you know, I pointed out the flaws that I, you know, I certainly perceived. So, you know, I think there are elements that are very strong, like the world building, you know, is excellent. You know, the, you have the underworld, you have the earth, you have Olympus, you know, very well-defined, you know, entertaining, you know, very, very interesting elements there. And, you know, but I think the whole thing just sort of collapses under its own complexity and sort of misdirection and lack of purpose as you sort of, you know, meander, you know, that's a pun, meander through, you know, eight episodes.
Right. And so you have Olympus, which is the home of the gods. It's sort of, they present as this, you know, luxury resort, basically, right?
Yeah, like I put in, it's sort of like what you, a Vanity Fair, what a Vanity Fair shoot would look like if mischievous Marxist, got a hold of the camera. You know, it sort of exposes the pimples on the nose and things like that.
Yeah. And then you have the Hades underworld, which is shot in this kind of, in this black and white, which is kind of
really
interesting.
It really struck me, like I just had a flashback to, you know, Eraserhead and Lynch's depictions, right, of that sort of factory-like, eerie, but, you know, just sort of dead to all sensitivity environment. Yeah.
And our scenes on Earth, you say they take place on Crete mostly?
Yeah, it's sort of confusing. Again, this is an element in the series that, you know, there's a lot of loose threads. And, you know, Crete is where, you know, sort of the action on Earth takes place. Yeah, so you sort of have like, you know, I think I mentioned like an Eli Roth hostel era vibe for the, you know, sort of congested middle European sort of environment that's presented, right? You've got a lot of, you know, club kids, you know, look like they're
evil tourism.
Yeah. Mad Max refugees and wise falafel vendors who, you know, dispense wisdom with their dollop of, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Well, all right. So, well, here's the thing, you know, what I like about the Greek gods, you know, I think about what I think is to this day still the best depiction ever of the Greek gods on the screen, which was the 1978 Clash of the Titans, which I'm sure left an impression on you as well.
And Charlie Koval, she mentions, that's her preferred pronoun.
Okay.
Koval mentions a huge influence for Clash of the Titans. She mentioned in some of the interviews prior to release that she watched it relentlessly as a child.
Yeah.
And you can see that. But go ahead, please.
Well, I'm saying like what was, I mean, yes, you watched 1978's Clash of the Titans. Ray Harryhausen special effects aside, it's a little dated in the way the, you know, the gods talk and the sort of the cinematography, but you feel the myth is so strong, you know, and the telling of the story is so, it's very visceral and it feels very real. And
well, that's interesting, Neil, because you're capturing the idea of the grandeur of the gods.
Yes.
Like the whole idea of Olympus, right? You want to be on Olympus, right? And the grandeur of everything. And that is something they sort of really rub in the mud in this series, like purposely. And again, your tolerance for that and whether you come to like reimaginings of the Greek gods for that will have a huge impact on whether you enjoy this or not.
I also feel like there's a huge gap between Sir Laurence Olivier as Zeus and Jeff Goldblum.
Yes. Yeah, it is sort of, most of the rest of the cast is British, but there's sort of that, you know, multi-ethnic, that easy multicultural blend that you get in the UK that you don't see in North America. You know, you see the London urban area where everyone speaks the same accent regardless of ethnicity, right? And there's that sort of easy at the pub camaraderie.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is something that, you know, lends an attraction to this series. And Jeff Goldblum seems slightly out of place in that environment.
Well, and that's the thing, is like you watch modern British TV, it is colorblind casting is easy in the modern UK because it really, I mean, in a lot of ways is a colorblind society, whereas it can seem somewhat jarring still in the U.S., which is a multicultural, multi-ethnic society, but there's still vast differences between cultures here.
Yeah. And I think what you say too about the casting is interesting, because you can have like, it's got some really imaginative, diverse casting. And that's very good when you sort of cast against traditional Hollywood type. But just because someone is not conventionally attractive, that does not mean they instantaneously have charisma, right? Al Pacino, Humphrey Bogart, like they were not conventionally attractive, but they had star power. You know, they had what, you know, you, I guess in modern terms, they have what they call main character energy. And I think a lot of the, you know, I found I did not invest emotionally in a lot of the, you know, the main characters in Chaos, not because they were diverse or, you know, but because they just didn't have that main character energy.
Yeah. There's also a heavy kind of a transgender theme going on in Chaos, which, you know, is very modern.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I would say, I guess I wouldn't say it's necessarily transgender, but I think some of the comments have been it's very queer, right? And in a positive sense, that you know, that sort of ethos, that sort of approach is there. And you have Eddie Izzard is in it. You have, you know, various cameos and things like that. So that feel is there. And to your point, one of the main characters is an Amazon, and this is sort of a nice twist, an Amazon who, you know, transitioned from being a woman to a man. Mm-hmm. And so I think those elements are there as well, right? And again, you know, people's dispositions will determine, you know, whether that's engaging for them or not.
Well, I mean, there's a lot, you know, I mean, classical Greek culture was very queer. So canonically so, and that was known even when we were kids. So that's not anything new. I guess to me, what sounds like is missing from Chaos is that sort of sense of fun and playfulness that gave Clash of the Titans, for instance, despite its, like, you know, its heavy action sequences and its big themes, it made it appealing to people of all ages.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say it, because certainly they strive for fun, right? There is, you know, and one of the issues, you know, has been tonal, like, you know, because the shifts in tone can be quite rapid and striking. And, you know, some people use that as a stylistic distraction. But they certainly aim for fun. Whether they achieve it or not, I guess will depend on the sensibility of the viewer. I found it, you know, a little bit heavy-handed at some points.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about the American Gods TV show as well. It's just like, all right, stop. We get it. Stop beating us over the head. Show the gods doing god things. Stop just dragging us through it all. So, all right, well, Chaos is on Netflix now. If you are British, you will think it's a masterpiece, apparently. If you are not, your mileage may vary. Samuel Porteous has joined us from Shanghai, China. Now, Sam, you may go to bed.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks so much, Samuel Porteous, for talking to me about Chaos, which is being chaotic on Netflix right now. Also, thanks to Pablo Gallaga for talking to me about Strange Darling, which is in some theaters in some cities at the moment, and to Stephen Garrett for talking to me about Beetlejuice, which is in every theater in every city at the moment. Both movies are at least entertaining, if not better, and I recommend you see them. I recommend you see most movies, because it's fun to go to the movies, and it's fun to talk about movies and books and streaming TV on this podcast, and to write and edit articles about them on Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor of that site, the host of this podcast, and your pop culture friend, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.